Senator from Cole.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of Senate Bills for Perfection, informal calendar. I'd ask you to recognize the Senator from Phelps County on Senate Bill 19.
Senator from Phelps, what reason do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that Senate Substitute Number 2 for Senate Bill 19 be brought from the informal calendar and brought to the floor for discussion.
Senator from Phelps has moved the Senate Substitute Number 2 for Senate Bill 19 to be brought from the formal calendar to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from Cole. Senator from Phelps.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, we've been discussing for a couple of days Senate Bill 19. And we are on Senate Substitute Number 2. And I will gladly try to answer questions or listen to discussion, whichever is the best way to go.
Further discussion on Senate Substitute Number 2 for Senate Bill Number 19. Discussion. Senator from 13th, what reason do you rise?
Mr. President, I have an amendment.
Send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
The amendment has not been distributed. I'll wait till it would be distributed. I request a waiver of the reading. I can explain it.
Senator from 13th, has moved. You moved for the adoption of the amendment, Senator?
I move for the adoption, but yes, Senator,
and
I move for the
Senator
adoption.
Senator moves the adoption amendment. Amendment number 3 on Senate Substitute Number 2, Senate Bill 19. She waives the reading, and she will not close until the amendment is distributed. Would you care to explain your amendment, Senator?
Sure, Mr. President. Thank you. This amendment, I don't have it in front of me, but this is what it does. It addresses the civil penalties, once again, in the substitute, the new substitute, and it makes it an infraction. No jail time, but the maximum of a $400 fine.
Senator from the 13th, we believe your amendment is drafted to the original bill.
We are working on that right now.
So we're working on that. If you want to have some of your...
While she goes ahead and explains, we'll go ahead and get it fixed.
Okay, I've been instructed that you can go ahead and explain your amendment. We'll try to get this straightened out and see how your amendment can drafted.
And I'm...
Be drafted correctly, okay?
Yes.
Okay. You want to continue explaining your amendment?
That was it, Senator. It just changes that section there, and that would be found on, I better get the right draft to read it to you from. It would be on page 2, probably line 14. And it is line 14, and it would change, take that out, and then put in infraction, with the penalty being a maximum of a $400 fine. So it removes any provision of this section shall be any person who violates or directs another to violate. Any provision comes out. Any provision of this section shall be guilty of a Class C misdemeanor, and then it would read, any person who violates or directs another to violate any provisions of this section shall be guilty of an infraction with a fine not to exceed $400.
I think we're okay on the...
Mr. President, was it drafted to the wrong sub? Because I do have...
It was, but is... It was... But we took care of it.
Another one later that would need to be fixed, and I ask that my staff get it and fix it now before I offer it so we don't go through this again, if that's okay.
Okay, I would suggest you can do that while you're...
Yes.
Okay. Senator from the 13th has moved for the adoption of Amendment 3 to Senate Substitute Number 2, Senate Bill 19. Further discussion. Senator from the 13th.
I'll be happy to answer any questions if not.
Further discussion. Senator from Phelps, what reason do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. May I inquire of the senator from the 13th?
Senator from 13th, yield?
Yes, I do. Thank
proceed.
You.
Proceed.
Now, here I am bailing you out again until your amendment gets out on the floor. explain to me, now we're on page 2, line 14, correct?
Yes, Senator, but I want to go back to that previous statement, bailing me out again. If you really want to bail me out,
no.
We can, I've got some things we can work on together.
Yeah. Okay. So what you want to do is remove
Thank
guilty
you.
Of a Class C misdemeanor and change that to a $400.
It says, yeah, and here I have it in front of me now. It
yes.
says, by striking the following, a Class C misdemeanor and inserting in lieu thereof the following, an infraction.
Okay.
So, I mean, there was some discussion, I forget, between maybe you and the senator from Kansas City.
I think that's right. Yeah.
And... Yeah, I don't see her in the chamber right now, but she did have an issue with that, with the misdemeanor portion of it, where if you remember before my original amendment that we started with yesterday, I had a problem with the provision that would allow people to bring civil suits against contractors.
Yes, yes.
So, and that's what it does. It takes it from... Class C misdemeanor to an infraction.
Yes. Okay. I think they're passing out the amendment now, and I have a pretty good feeling of what you're doing, and I may speak against your amendment later, but I want to hear the discussion on the amendment, and I will sit down until you get finished.
Thank you, Senator.
Further discussion on Amendment 3. Senator from the 1st, what reason you're asked?
To inquire of the Senator from the 13th.
Senator from 13th, yield?
I do.
Proceed.
So your amendment simply takes Class C misdemeanor and makes it an infraction?
Correct.
Well, that's simple enough, and I'm sure the Senator from Phelps will weigh in as he sees appropriate on that. I actually want to go off topic for just a minute, Senator.
And you want to what?
Go off topic for just a minute. And express something that's been bothering me.
Okay.
It's Tuesday night. Do you remember where we were last Tuesday night?
I don't. But you know what? I can look at my calendar. Senator, I got 20 years on you.
I understand.
And you know what? The stuff that it must, if it wasn't really, really, really important...
Well, it was really, really important, Senator.
Was really? Now, don't...
I'll give you a hint. You were in the building. You were in the chamber, just not this chamber.
Oh, I was at the State of the State.
You were at the State of the State?
Yeah, the 17th. If you would have said what happened on the 17th, I could have told you that.
Well, see, I tricked you with last Tuesday night.
Once again.
I want to hone in on a particular passage from the State of the State. Because as I have had some matters brought to my attention, I just think it's something that that needs to be pointed out. I want to do it as respectfully as I can, but it's a circumstance that I just think somebody needs to raise their hand and say, folks should know that this is what transpired. Do you remember there was a passage in the State of the State talking about recidivism?
Yes.
And I'm just going to quote that passage in its entirety. The governor said, I believe, as many of you do, that we must reform our correction system. I believe our correction officers do hard work under difficult circumstances, and I'm committed to standing by them and standing up for them. You remember?
I remember
the governor?
That.
Yep. And he said, in order to protect them, and in fact, in order to protect every citizen in Missouri, we need to find ways to reduce recidivism. Somebody gets out of prison, we want them to go to work. We want them to pay their fair share in taxes. We want them to take care of their kids. We want them to set a good example.
Absolutely.
And I couldn't agree with the governor more about that. He went on to say the last thing that we want is somebody coming out of prison and committing another crime which hurts another family and starts that same bad cycle all over again. He said we need to do different. people who are in prison should have a clear plan from the day they enter about what direction their lives will take the day they leave. He said, to tackle this problem, we need to engage groups from across society, most importantly our faith community. I've seen that a turn towards faith can actually save lives in prison. I will welcome our churches and synagogues into our corrections facilities. He said, these steps are the beginning, and the path towards safer streets for all is built on a combination of support for law enforcement, relationships rooted in understanding economic and educational opportunity, and a justice system that has the confidence of all of its citizens. And in fairness to him, he talked about recidivism, and he talked about preventing recidivism while people are incarcerated. There's another really important component to that, and that is reentry.
That is what?
Reentry programs.
Right, yeah.
And I believe that our offender reentry programs provide critical services to try to help folks as they are leaving our correction system to find the right path and move forward in a direction that is absolutely consistent with the vision articulated by the governor. The reason I raise all this right now is, and this is a totally unfair question, I ask you if you remember what you're doing last Tuesday night. You remember what happened last Monday, Senator?
Yeah.
Last Monday, the new administration released its first round of budget withholds. Budget withholds are a fact of life when we have revenue shortfalls, and any administration, especially a new administration, is confronted with making very difficult choices. Sometimes, we talked earlier about prosecutorial offices sometimes having to prioritize crimes that they focus on given a lack of infinite resources. Well, state government has a lack of infinite resources, and governors have to make very difficult decisions when there's a shortfall anticipated for the end of the fiscal year with our balanced budget amendment in deciding what to withhold and what to release. Can you guess where this is going, Senator?
Keep going, Senator. I'm pretty sure I can.
So line 52 from the withholds was like almost $1 million withheld from our state's reentry programs. The line item is $972,406 withheld from local sentencing initiatives. That includes a couple of different organizations that provide reentry services to our offenders. And what concerns me is that we have the temporal juxtaposition of withholds on Monday, followed by a speech talking about how important all of this is on Tuesday. And I didn't grab this microphone to cast aspersions. And in fairness, reading the State of the State closely, I think one could argue that he wasn't necessarily directly talking about reentry programs, although I think it's a fair interpretation of what he was referring to. My biggest concern is I particularly early on, I just want to make sure that folks in the second branch of government know that it is really, I mean, look, there's a lot of moving parts here. A lot of things can happen in different sequencing, and sometimes the timing can look like what it's not. And sometimes, let's face it, the right hand just doesn't know what the left hand is doing. And I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that probably somebody who is intimately familiar with the withhold document, a budget person, and speechwriter probably didn't sit down and review each other's work and come to the conclusion that, you know, we might want to be a little bit more clear about what we're talking about, what we're not. And I don't want to be unfair. I'm not doing this to be critical. I'm just saying, man, when you withhold on Monday and you talk about how important it is on Tuesday, it is awfully hard for me not to say something about it. And that being said, it would be my hope that the revenue forecast will improve. It would be my hope that these funds can be released. And I stand ready, willing, and able to work with this administration to help not only support our reentry programs, but also to do some of the things the governor was talking about for folks while they're incarcerated. But we've got to do it all. And it's just, I think, important for the folks that are working on these things to know that people in this chamber and people in the chamber across the hall are just going to be working very diligently to make sure that we're all on the same page and that we're all being held accountable for what we say, myself included, first and foremost. So I hope I haven't come across as breathing fire on this, Senator. I just found the timing awfully hard for me to not say something about.
Senator, may I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Do you know where a lot of those people end up?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of them.
Do you know that a lot of places they go for employment are the labor unions? And you know why? Because they kind of feel like they have paid their debt to society and they're not judgmental. So a lot of them have a lot of the ex-offenders have the opportunity to go through our apprenticeship programs. I worked with a couple of guys through my career that was the issue with them. They ended up making a good living. They ended up retiring. They retired, and they never were repeat offenders. That's another thing. We have a feather in our cap.
And to the governor's point, unfortunately, all too many of them wind up right back in the correction system. And,
absolutely.
And reentry programs are, in many ways, along with the programming in the Department of Corrections, the front line of defense against recidivism. As a state, we need to do a better job of it. I mean, what taxpayers pay for people who are incarcerated again in this state is a tax burden that every Missourian carries. It's a tax burden that we either wouldn't have to pay or that we could use those funds to do other important things.
Sure.
Given the scarcity of resources. I didn't want to take an hour and a half. I know that many of us are not super anxious to get to the conclusion of this particular debate. I didn't want to take all night. I just felt before much more time went by, folks get withheld, they pick up the phone and we hear from them and that's how it goes. And if I hadn't heard it with my own ears, the talk of recidivism on Tuesday night, and then the phone rings on Friday with, we got withheld. And it's not, I don't want to see people punished for calling their senator and saying we got withheld, but I just think it's important for folks to know that we don't act in a vacuum. We don't talk in a vacuum.
Right. Hey, I agree, Senator. I found out a statistic today, and I don't know if they came round to see you, but they were, I forget what they were working on, but they might have been working on a needle program. I don't know. I don't remember, but a fact they told me that I didn't realize that somebody that spends just 3 days in jail, chances are more than likely they're going to end up back there again.
Yeah. We don't want repeat customers. No, it is sad.
No, we have a lot of repeat customers, but we don't want repeat customers. We never know what's going on in somebody's mind or in their lives or what the circumstances are and some of the crimes they commit. But that's what the system's supposed to be for.
Yeah.
Back on the right track.
We call it corrections for a reason.
Right, yeah, right. And a productive citizen, and that's all of us want, I think.
Well, I just wanted to share that with you. I was just kind of surprised and just wanted to bring it to your attention, to the body's attention, and frankly, respectfully, to the executive branch's attention.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Further discussion? Senator from the 24th, what reason do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. To inquire of the Senator from the 13th, please.
Senator from the 13th, yield.
I do.
And proceed.
Senator, I'm putting my microphone on the correct side. Thanks, Senator. I just wanted to run through your amendment. I think it's pretty clear, but I wanted to understand a little bit more about the rationale behind it. So a Class C felony that is written in there currently under the current legislation that's proposed, you're replacing, I'm sorry, a Class C misdemeanor. Do you know what that results in?
I imagine some jail time and a fine, because it's no longer, I think after the revision, and I don't see the senator from Green in the chamber who worked on that bill, and I believe they talked about it before. Now we've added a new level of misdemeanor, so
right.
It's no longer, and maybe the senator from the first or the second could shake their head and tell me that now a Class C used to be the lowest and is not anymore, and now a Class D is the lowest after the new code has been proposed. But right. That is my assumption.
All right, so we're moving from jail time to an infraction, and I know that when you talked about it, you said an infraction with a fine not to exceed $400. So
right.
That's the definition of what an infraction is
yes.
A fine not, and so that would be determined by, well, now we know it would be determined by either the circuit judge or the attorney general, because we did not
right.
Pass that
or
amendment.
The circuit court.
Are the circuit
depending
court.
On where you are, you know,
prosecuting attorney, right?
Class D now, under the new system, no jail time and a maximum fine of $500.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that a Class C is a little heftier than that.
Well, and you know,
and then an infraction is, of course, the most lenient.
Right. So when I take what you talked about in terms of the even short amount of time that somebody spends incarcerated and their propensity then to repeat and end up, whether it's that crime or some other, to end up back as an offender incarcerated again. And what the senator from the first talked about with the idea that, you know, we need to be investing in our reentry programs so that we can help people become contributing members of society, get jobs, take care of themselves, pay taxes, take care of their families. I think the alternative of going from jail time to this infraction, which is a fine, which is not an insignificant fine at up to $400, but I think that might be a much better way to go about trying to minimize the pressure on our prison system and also trying to make sure that we don't put people in a position where we are sort of teaching them or sending them down to down a pathway to become repeat offenders because of the amount of time they might spend in jail even prior to sentencing. So, I think, you know, what you've done is it's smart, it makes sense to me, and I think it makes sense on a lot of levels based on what all of us want for the working families in the state of Missouri and for the people of the state of Missouri. We don't want to throw them in jail, have them lose their job, have them lose their ability to earn a living and take care of themselves. So I appreciate the work, and I thank you for the inquiry.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? Senator from the 7th, what reason you rise?
Mr. President, I'd like to inquire the Senator from the 21st.
Senator from the 21st. Senator from the 21st.
Benny.
Would you please try to find the Senator from the 21st? Senator Johnson, you yield?
I do.
Proceed.
Good evening, Senator.
Good evening.
You were a little bit of Kaiser Soze there, not being able to be found.
Found a good hiding spot, I guess.
Did you enjoy your dinner this evening?
I did. Had very good company.
Yeah, you know, it just goes to show that Republicans and Democrats can still get together and break bread, even though we have contentious issues in front of us, and enjoy the time. I wanted to bring you out and talk a little bit, and I may talk to the senator sitting next to you a little bit. It's been the sort of pattern that the same party will talk to each other when we have contentious issues, and I want to kind of get away from that with some of you new senators here. You guys support this bill, you support this legislation, and I want to know why. I want to hear from your position representing your district why you support this bill and what you think the positive outcomes are going to be, because I see the unintended consequences of this bill in a different way than you do. So I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what we're doing here tonight.
Thank you, Senator, for the inquiry. You know, this is a bill we've voted on many times when I was over in the House of Representatives as a state representative, and I just truly believe and believe that constituents, the majority of constituents in my district, should not be forced to join a union.
How often do you hear from them? Is this something that you would categorize as a priority issue where when you go to the grocery store or you were at the gas station that people come up to you and say, oh, you're Representative Hoskins or you're Senator Hoskins, can you you're right. I deserve a gavel, Mr. President. Okay. Is this something where they approach you and bring up, is this an issue in your district that you're hearing about?
I think it is an issue that my constituents and the businesses in my district believe will help the district and will bring bring jobs to the area. You know, in my district, I do not have a heavy union membership in my district, and so the majority of my constituents a lot of my constituents aren't really familiar with right to work and the pros and the cons. And so out on the campaign trail in the 21st Senatorial District, this wasn't the question of right to work wasn't one that came about, to be honest with you, all that often. Most of the time they were talking about, I talk about Big Government Get Off My Back Act and just things that we could do as a state in order to get big government off the backs of our small businesses. And I talked about the federal intrusion on our family farms, whether it's the EPA or DNR. I talked about Department of Revenue coming into our small businesses and changing the rules and letting them know that or informing them that they owed taxes that they didn't know that they had to collect. And then when I also talked about keeping the federal government out of my daughter's fifth-grade bathroom. And so those were really the three big issues that really resonated with the residents of my district. Right to work wasn't something on the top of their minds because, like I said, I just don't have a very heavy union membership in my district.
But let me ask you this question, and thank you for that. Only 8% of the labor force are unionized. 8%. At least 92% of those who are of age, who are able-bodied, who go out there and work for a living, that are not a part of a union.
And I would say probably 8% would be high in my district versus your district. What would the percentage be in your district?
It's probably a little higher, Nate. I've got really strong working-class families that are in the South and then in the North. I would say probably 12%, if I had to guess, probably 10 to 12%, maybe a little higher than the state average in my district. I know that in the senator from the north of me, in his district, it's much higher than that. And everybody's district is going to have, based on what's located there, so he has the Clay Como plant. Clearly the UAW are going to have a pretty good percentage of folks that live in that area. So I guess it kind of depends on what development is in your district. But here's my question, and this is why I ask you to sort of talk this through with me. You said that there are other issues that you heard about more frequently in your campaign, and that because perhaps you don't have as many people that are engaged in union activities, that this issue didn't raise to the level of being the number one thing that folks wanted to talk to you about. But and in addition to that, where there are a lot of union folks of a higher percentage of the labor force, they're typically in districts that are here in this Senate chamber arguing against this bill, typically. Maybe not always, but typically. But yet, with all the things that you mentioned, with all the challenges that we have as a state, this is the first thing that we've chosen to prioritize as a chamber, as an assembly. And I just don't understand why those of us who represent large union districts don't want this, and those of you who don't necessarily represent large percentage of union districts maybe not be the most pressing issue, then why is it the first thing that we've chosen to prioritize?
Well, Senator, I would say that, yes, although I don't have a heavy union membership in my district, and this definitely wasn't, when I would go to all the candidate forums, wasn't the main pressing issue, probably unlike my fellow senator from St. Charles County, where I think it probably was the number one pressing issue. I would say, you know, my title, I'm not a district senator. I'm a state senator. And so I do, when we debate on these particular bills and go through the pros and cons and we, you know, try to flush out the good and bad things about each bill and vet each bill, I think that in order for Missouri to compete with other states that are bringing jobs and economic growth and manufacturing jobs, this is definitely one of the tools. Now, that being said, I would also say that, okay, how many states are right to work?
I think they said we would be the 28th.
We'd be the 28th. So we would be the 28th state to have right to work. And I think that that would definitely give us some advantages versus the other 22 states that are not, that would not be right to work. But what happens when the 50th state becomes right to work? What other economic or incentives and economic programs will we have in order to incentivize jobs and manufacturing and economic, you know, development to come here to the state? So I think that right to work is one piece of the puzzle. I don't think it's the answer to all of our state's problems, but as a state senator and knowing that my vote affects the state of Missouri, not just my district, and trying to look out for the state of Missouri in general, that's the reason I vote for it.
Well, and I think that's an understandable reason for you to suggest why you're supporting the legislation. But what I don't understand, what I'm still kind of confused about, is that I've been here for 10 years. This is my 11th session in the General Assembly. And through all this time, even back in 2007 when I was a freshman House member, this issue has been a discussion that's been sort of this golden calf of the Republican agenda. They have prioritized passing right to work as a priority for an entire decade that I've been here. And in that time, in the decade that I've been here, I can't remember one time, not one time, where a rank and file union member, where a UAW member or an IBEW member or an SEIU member, the actual members themselves, have ever come to me and said, "This is important to me. Would you please support right to work?" Because as a forced union member, as what we've heard multiple times this evening and yesterday, I want you to free me from this bond. I want you to support this. Not one time in 10 years have I ever heard a rank-and-file member come to me and ask me to take this position. Now, if they're not clamoring for a change, and we know what you would categorize as union leadership, you can call them union bosses or however you want to categorize it. We know they're not clamoring for a change. And I'm not hearing from the 92% of the rest of the labor force whose wages are artificially improved because of the collective bargaining that the labor unions provide. If I'm not hearing from them, where are we hearing this from? Where is the desire to make this the number one priority? The number one priority for this Senate chamber to come out in this new session with you new members, and before we even debate a bill on debt or on taxes or on economic incentives or on something that would help that 92% that's not in the union, this is the bill that we've chosen to trot out as the first and most important bill. Yet, I don't know where's that impetus coming from. I have an idea, but I would like to know where you think that it's coming from.
I think it's coming from a variety of different sources. I think it's coming from companies that look at Missouri and that meet with the Missouri Chamber of Commerce, that meet with the city of St. Louis, the city of Kansas City, and look at, you know, they've got all these different checklists that they look through, and one of them, I think, is Missouri a right to work state? And no, it's not. And I think that derails our chances of getting some some of those businesses to come here.
Okay, then, so I'll stop right there. Hold on. I agree with you. I went to Lake of the Ozarks for a site selector meeting that the chamber put on, and the site selectors came in, and they talked about what's important. Right to work was on the list. It was not in the top five, educated workforce, infrastructure, being able to move goods and services. Those were the most important things that they looked at, but I will agree, and I will concede, that right to work was on the list of things. But here's my question. Why? What is it about right to work that makes that company say, I want to move there versus there? What are they trying to get at? Like, what benefit is it to their corporation that a state is right to work versus being unionized? Less wages? Cheaper employment? What could it be that makes that something that they want?
You have the answer, Senator.
Well, I can only look at the statistics that we have of what happens in right to work afterwards. But I'm not trying to put you on the spot as a parliamentary debate procedure. I really am trying to figure out what it is about this law that makes someone who wants to invest in a community say, in the absence of that policy, we're less likely to move there. So my question is, okay, in the presence of that policy, what benefit does this provide your company that makes you want to be here?
I think that one of the things is those companies can deal with employees individually, and they can reward employees that exceed expectations and their performance, and versus having to collectively bargain with the union. But then you ask who is in favor of this. Our Governor Greitens. Governor Greitens said that this was one of his main priorities, right to work. And he campaigned that across the state and ended up victorious on November 8th. So as we had Governor Nixon for 8 years, and I know Governor Nixon probably came to you and Senate Democrats and said, hey, these are my priorities. I'd like for you to champion these priorities. Well, Governor Greitens campaigned it was no secret where he stood on this issue on right to work. He campaigned on right to work. He said that if I want to get right to work to my desk, I want to sign right to work, I think this will help the economy here in Missouri. And so it's one of our Governor Greitens' priorities. And as a priority for Governor Greitens, it's one of my priorities as well.
Thank you, Senator. I want to take a minute. Let's pause this conversation. You're in the Senate now. It's not the House. We don't have time limits. We can talk as long as we want. We can talk about whatever we want. So I want to take a break from what we were talking about here, and I want to just ask you about any subject. Just pick a subject that you want to talk about, just to demonstrate that you're not going to get gaveled down for being off topic.
Any subject, wow.
Subject.
We could talk about innovation campuses. We could talk about big government, get off my back act.
Hold on. Let's go back to innovation campuses. So you have CMS. Well, it's not CMSU anymore. It's UCM.
Right.
And UCM partnered with some private businesses to create the innovation campuses.
Correct.
And what can you report on how well that...
It's been a great success story. University of Central Missouri's partnered with not only Warrensburg School District, but the Lee Summit School District. They have an Innovation Center campus in Lee Summit. They have a program where a high school student from Lee Summit can go into the Innovation Campus Center and graduate from high school with an associate's degree and then graduate college in partnership with UCM in 2 to 3 years with their bachelor's degree, all the meanwhile having a three-year internship with companies such as Cerner, a paid internship, and a job guaranteed upon graduation. So we started to see the first graduates from the Innovation Center campus, I believe, were this past May of 2016.
How many are we talking about? Folks go through there. I mean, just ballpark.
I don't know how many graduates, and I'd hate to even ballpark and guess, Senator, because I would be...
You also have Whiteman Air Force Base in your district.
Yes.
And the former Senator David Pierce, your predecessor, he would lead a tour of the base and would invite all of us to come down. I brought my son twice now. My dad wants to go. And we got to, you know, kick the tires on the B-2 and climb around in it.
Right.
And I enjoy that. Are you going to continue that tradition?
We will continue that tradition. And, in fact, working on something for possibly this summer.
Good. Well, I look forward to being a part of that. And UCM does a great job of partnering with white men. And I think that's one of the draws. We talk about having a state that's friendly towards veterans. UCM and white men are a great example of how when you put your mind to it, you can really make it a good place to serve the military in the state of Missouri.
They are. I would agree.
Well, Senator, I appreciate this inquiry. You've done a great job. Thank you very much. Mr. President.
Senator from the 7th.
To inquire of the Senator from the 23rd.
Senator from the 23rd, do you yield?
I do, Mr. President.
Senator proceeds.
Good evening.
Good evening, Senator.
I just wanted to take a minute and get your thoughts on the pending legislation in front of us. I know that Senator Schaaf kind of put you through the ringer the other day. Senator from the 34th put you through the ringer the other day. And I wanted to...
Senator from Buchanan.
Senator from Buchanan put you through the ringer. Senator from the 1st needs to mind his own business. So I asked the same two questions to you. Very simple. The first question is of all the priorities that we have as a state, this is the first thing that we've chosen to lead with, the very first bill that we brought onto the floor. And are you and your district feeling like if we solve this, then, man, we are just marching our way to prosperity and that it's the most important? Is, in your mind, this the most important issue that we face as a state?
Well, I think this is one of the issues that we face as a state. I've never said that passage of this particular bill would be a panacea to economic success.
That's a good word.
For the state of Missouri. However, I have often been quoted as talking about this bill, passage of this bill, as one of the elements that will make the state of Missouri competitive with other states. And really, to answer your question, I support it for two reasons. One is philosophical. From the perspective of, I don't think that a third-party agreement should be able to prevent someone from maintaining their employment. So what I mean by that is I don't think that a third party should be able to negotiate with someone who's a direct party to an employment arrangement to in any way infringe upon the right to maintain employment. And I think that without this law, I believe that many of the citizens are vulnerable
okay.
to that.
Let's talk about that for just a second.
Okay.
So what is the purpose of that third party in the process of that negotiation? Historically, why do you think that it's done this way? What was the benefit of creating this system, this unionized system?
Well, if my understanding is correct, you're talking about the purpose of collective bargaining.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do this? If what you're saying philosophically that a third party should not be speaking on behalf of an employee, then why do we do it?
Well, I've always understood the benefit in certain situations of collective bargaining is to increase the leverage of the employees when negotiating compensation, safety practices, and so forth from the employer.
Okay, will that leverage, if this passes, will that leverage be weakened?
No, I don't believe so, because the employee will still have the right and the opportunity to collectively bargain. That I don't believe that anyone is losing that right to collectively bargain.
Okay, so let me give you a scenario. So a labor union that's going to construct the new soccer stadium for St. Louis, and they're in the process of writing the contract for not only just the wages but also the benefits, the worker safety, all of the different aspects that go into a labor contract. If half of those members choose not to pay their dues and say, I want all of the good things that come along with that negotiation, but I'm not willing to pay my portion, my share of that burden that pays the negotiators to do the research, to develop the strategies, to speak on their behalf, because there's skill sets involved here in those negotiations.
that are different than the same skill sets that's required to swing the hammer. And in order to have those skill sets, you have to pay somebody who has that talent to be able to be the person who's doing the negotiating. Half the people decide they're not going to pay their dues. So the person who is doing the negotiation, the best talent, can no longer be afforded. And that person is no longer speaking on behalf of the whole group. You don't think that that lessens and weakens their ability to get a better deal?
Well, I think in the example that you're giving, Senator, there's a couple assumptions that I don't know actually occurred in reality in everyday life. In certain instances, in the instance that you describe, I don't think that there's also any prohibition against members-only agreements, so that the benefits of the negotiated collective bargaining arrangement would only cover those who are actually paying the dues into the system in the first place, so that those that weren't paying into the system wouldn't be the beneficiary or, in the opposite sense, the damaged party from any arrangement that was negotiated.
So in that sense, would they, I mean, and I don't, because I'm not a labor contract negotiator, and I was a member of the AFT union for 5 years when I was a teacher in the Kansas City, Missouri school district. My wife is a member of MNEA, so we have the experience of what that union looks like and how they go about interacting with their members. But I'm not a member of the building and trades, and I haven't been a part of that. So what you're saying is that in that scenario, the half that doesn't pay their membership would not get the benefits of the collectively bargained contract. Is that what you're saying?
My understanding is those individuals would be, it would be incumbent upon them to negotiate their own employment agreement with the employer in that case, yes.
So if you're the employer and you're going to build a soccer stadium, do you think it's a proper use, not proper, do you think it's a valuable use of time to have 50, 60, 80 different negotiations going on how you're going to pay each one of those laborers? Is that a good use of time?
Well, I tell you, in my own small business, I negotiated the employment agreement of every one of my employees. Now, sure. Does that increase with the number of employments that you get? Well, of course it does. Yeah. But at the same time, as a company grows, you're also going to have more managers in that company that can continue to negotiate individual employment contracts. So, again, this is a scalability of a business issue, and I don't think that the freedom that an employer or an employee will be infringed upon by only having certain segments of that employment population as bound by a collective bargaining agreement.
Okay, let me ask the question that I asked the senator from the 21st. When a company decides that they're going to choose to locate to a state that has or does not have right to work, what is it about that policy that benefits that company to say, we will choose the right to work state over the non-right to work state? What do they get in return for it being that?
That's a great question, Senator, and I think the answer to that particular question is, we go back to the liberty issue. If I am an employer in a different state, and I believe that as a result of moving to a state like Missouri, that the employment agreements that are signed, have been signed, may be signed in that state, could be subject to the influences of a third party that may or may not have the best interests of both the employee and the employer in mind, that's a red flag. And I say that as someone who's been a small business owner. So with right-to-work legislation, with the environment that's set up by right-to-work legislation, now the employer knows that there cannot be third-party interference in the agreements that they're going to be signing with their employees. And I think that's an environment that is attractive, and we've seen that over and over, that businesses are moving to those states.
Okay, let me flip that on its head. Let me give you a red flag of this bill. Let's say that I'm an employer, and I want the freedom to do business with a clothes shop. I'm going to build this building. I want to know that every single person who's in my building working on it has been trained, gone through an apprentice program, and actually is a skilled laborer. And I want that union to have its members be paid members because I know what that entails, what they get. You, not the proverbial you, the proverbial we, you, in this legislation, are criminalizing my freedom to engage in a closed workshop. So basically, you're saying the worker should have the freedom not to pay his dues, but yet at the same time, you're putting criminal provisions in for an employer who would choose to work with a shop and require It's like membership. If I want to join a golf club, and that golf club says, we're not going to allow anybody to wear denim in here. Our rules are you're going to wear khakis, and you're going to pay our membership fee in order to be here. Well, at that point, with the same logic, you're basically saying that in this member organization, which is what a union is, I can belong, but I don't have to pay for the services. And if I'm an employer who wants those laborers to be a member of that union, you are now making me a criminal. That doesn't sound like freedom to me.
Well, first of all, again, when we talk about members who choose not to, or excuse me, employees that choose not to pay the dues, the employer, and still continued in the state of Missouri, members-only agreement can be signed in order to make sure that those that are a part of the collective bargaining agreement are the only ones covered by said collective bargaining agreement.
And but second, am I just out? Okay, so example. I'm building a building. My company's name is JR Buildings. And JR Buildings is going to build a 20-story high-rise. And I'm going to hire only union electrical contractors. And I say to them, I want every single person who's going to string a wire in my building to be a member of your union, because I want them to have the apprentice training to do that, because I can't afford for there to be a mistake on floor four and then me have to go back and fix that. I need it to be perfect, and this is why we have the skilled trades. So as JR Buildings, I go to IEBW and I say, I don't want a single person on my property that's not a paid member of your union with a contract. The way I read this right here, I've just committed a crime.
Well, I don't believe that after passage of this bill, in the event that this bill passes, I don't believe there would be any prohibition from an employer choosing who they would like to hire for any given position.
But now, couldn't I then sue? If I'm a member in the union who chooses not to pay their dues, I choose not to do it. I'm going to pocket that. We heard that it was $12,000 over 8 years was the statistic that the maker of this bill said. So $12,000 over 8 years, you just do the math, it's what, $1,200 a year or something like that. I choose not to pay that. So, I'm going to put that in my pocket.
So what happens in this? So let's to follow in this example, what's going to happen in that case is if an employee who's employed by an employer who has signed a collective bargaining agreement decides, I no longer want to pay the bills, I no longer to pay the fees that are being charged by the union, and decides to leave the union. Under current laws right now, the employer has an obligation as a result of that CBA to say, you're fired because you're no longer a member of the union. That actually has nothing to do with the training or qualification that that employee has to continue serving in that role under that employment. After passage of right to work, the employee will have the right to stop paying their dues, and not be fired as a result of that action. So that's in my mind, that's a protection of the employee, and that's okay. A protection of their liberty.
So will the employee who is now under this law not allowed to be fired, is he allowed then to be on my property, JR Buildings, if I want to only do business with a shop that has paid membership?
But you're defining it by you're defining the qualification as an exclusive up or down issue of whether or not they're in a union. But that's that. Even though the status of union membership is associated with certain training that union member receives, the status itself is not actually the value. The value is the training itself.
But how do you
and
think
that individual
that
would still have that training regardless if they were in the union
have
or not?
Have you ever, I mean, I'm asking, have you ever visited the carpenter's training facility?
I have, in fact, shortly after my primary this year, I visited the operating engineer's local training facility north of St. Louis.
How do you think that gets paid for?
It is paid for with dues. In fact, we actually discussed this. By the way, they have a great facility up north of town. They provide a good environment for folks to come in, receive training, apprentices to come in and receive training, and they have a good connection to general contractors that they work with to provide employment. That's a great thing. I think that everyone that I've talked to, including the members of my caucus, are supportive of that type of activity. However, the way their system is set up, unless they are forced to pay dues as a result of forced unionization,
You're right. They don't have any current way under their existing setup to fund those particular activities. Now, let me give you a different analogy of how some other organizations do fund those type of activities. As you know, I think I told you that I'm an Air Force veteran. I went through the Reserve Officer Training Corps program at Purdue University in the late 1990s.
After university or during?
During my university
ROTC?
Studies. I went ROTC when I was going through the university. And
what school?
Purdue University.
Purdue.
The Boilermakers.
Indiana.
Long time ago. Not that long ago.
So were you commissioned as an officer right out?
I was. And what they required of me as a result of giving me that training throughout college was a requirement that I was going to serve in the United States Air Force for a period of years. In my case, it was 4 years. And that was a way that I was asked to pay back the investment that the Air Force had made in me. Now, I signed that agreement willingly, and it was had a set term. It wasn't an indefinite term in which I decided I was going to sign my life away and continue operating for as long as I was using those skill sets that I would be an employee of the United States Air Force. So there are other organizations, even government organizations I just described, that have found different ways to fund the training program. And as you know, probably one of the few institutions that has a more robust training program than the unions in our country is probably the military. The military is famous for training. Trust me, famous for training. So I think there are other models and examples, and I encourage the folks that I spoke with up at the Operating Engineers Training Facility to consider that.
The military has $720 billion in appropriations from the U.S. government that pays for...
But they still couldn't operate if the people that were raising their hand to take an oath to join the military weren't paying back that initial investment,
Let me give you a very sophomoric example. Were you in the Greek system at all when you were at Purdue? Were you in a fraternity, the Greek system?
I was in an Air Force fraternity.
Okay. I was a Pike at Mizzou and the Pike App Alpha House. And in addition to my tuition, in addition to my books, I also had room, boarding, lodging, and my fraternity dues. So my fraternity required me, I think it was like $4,000 a year back in 1994, 95, you know, and that covered my room, my cafeteria fees, and then my actual fraternity dues to the local chapter of Alpha Nu and to the national chapter of Pi Kappa Alpha. What do you think would happen if we all of a sudden said, hey, you can join the fraternity, but you don't have to pay your dues anymore? Do you think I would have paid those dues if I wasn't required to by proxy of living there? And if I stopped paying them, how long do you think the fraternity would have survived? If everybody just says, I don't want to pay these dues, I just want to come to the parties.
Well, I think one of the reasons that you probably joined that fraternity in the first place was you saw value in the environment, in the maybe it was educational training, the camaraderie that you felt that the fraternity, the membership in the fraternity was offering. And in an employment sense, folks are seeing...
We have another senator who is wanting to speak. I see that. But right now we're speaking. And you know what? In the Senate, nobody can take this floor from us until we're ready to give it up, Senator.
So I understand that in an employment scenario, if folks don't see, and this could be unions or otherwise, if folks don't see the value in maintaining a third-party membership that they're putting their own money towards, there shouldn't be a coercion of sorts that's requiring them to continue paying that membership at the cost of their employment.
Senator, I disagree. I mean, I appreciate at least the perspective that you have logically arrived at as to why you're voting the way you're voting. My logic takes me in another direction. I believe that if you don't require membership fees, that nobody's going to pay membership fees, and then the membership value goes down. I believe that it costs money to train people, and that money is derived as a part of the sacrifice of being a part of that group, because you don't have to be in that union. You don't have to be a part of that 8%. I also believe that it's been working just fine over the years, and I haven't heard from a single rank and file union member who came to me and said, this is a problem, I'd like for you to change this. I've heard from multiple employers and businesses who do business with labor unions and are satisfied and happy with that relationship, who have expressed that they don't think that this is the right direction for the state. People who do big things, big buildings in my district, are telling me this is not in the best interest of their private profits. So all of those reasons lead me to believe that this should not be our number one priority. The state is facing a lot of other challenges that we could be addressing. And I think that this is a political, and I use political in the actual electoral sense. This is a politically motivated policy change that is derived to have a certain outcome that is political. I believe that there are interests in this state, very successful interests, who have a lot of resources, who have made this their priority for whatever gain they seem to get out of this. Now, I've asked the question of both you and the senator from the 21st, what is it about this policy that makes a business want to relocate here? And I can appreciate that that's a pretty nuanced question, but it would be easy for me to ask those interests who have the resources, who have invested in this policy change, what they get out of it. I bet you that's a fairly easy question to answer for them. Or Senator, they wouldn't spend the money to make this happen.
Senator, I, honestly, one of the things, as I mentioned, this issue was brought up repeatedly in my primary, and part of the reason that a tremendous amount of money and investment and capital and time has been spent on this issue is precisely because that for folks on both sides of this issue, it is an incredibly emotional issue. In fact, almost every person that I talked to who were both supporting Right to Work or were against Right to Work were doing so and were speaking to me out of the passion and emotion that they held for the issue. And when emotions get involved, as you know, a lot of times that leads to an exaggeration of one discussion over another. And in many cases, that has happened with Right to Work. But I'll say this. If I thought that it was exclusively a political design, that would certainly not be something I would support. But at the same time, if you're worried that there are those that are looking at a political end, and I'm assuming, and I could be wrong, that that political end is the harm brought about to private sector unions, then I can't help but wonder, you know, union membership has been declining for many years now without passage of Right to Work.
You're right.
Certainly there must be bigger problems that the unions can address beyond even the Right to Work debate.
That's true. And you know, to a certain extent, I think if we were really peeling the onion, there are many that could make the same political charge that those on my side have a political gain to be made if the unions continue to be strong because of who they choose to support. But I would suggest two things. One, that has changed, that's evolved, and the unions have figured out that their best bet is to support both sides, and we have seen members of both parties receive support from unions. But let me tell you the thing that, and when we say unions as a collective ideal, and they need to be considered because they're the ones who are keeping that mean average wage up for the 92% that are not them. That collective bargaining and the prevailing wage that goes along with that, I know that's separate issues, but they're connected. Those things benefit. But I'm telling you that I'm standing on this floor right now, and you and I are having this inquiry because of the individual families, the men and women who wake up every morning and they go to work and they do the things that we idolize as a society. They swing that hammer. They and in some service unions, they change that diaper of the senior citizen who is in rehab. They clean the toilets. They do things that have to be done. And for me, the families that they represent, that middle class, the vacations they get to take, the benefits that they receive, the time off, all of that, that's what I'm fighting for. And that's what I don't want to be in jeopardy. I don't want that middle class family who would otherwise be on welfare or otherwise be a burden to the state, but who chose a craft where they could go get training, they could go through an apprenticeship school, and they could find some way to support their family that's above just surviving. I don't want to diminish their ability to continue to see that kind of life in this country. And there are plenty of countries who don't protect workers. There are plenty of countries who don't have OSHA standards. And you can go and see the quality of life that their citizens lead, and then compare them to the quality of life that our citizens lead. And ask yourself, why are we trying to diminish their ability to make good wages? And that's how what I see this policy as.
I would disagree with you in the sense that I don't think that it diminishes it. I think that it actually increases their liberty to negotiate their own wages in instances where they don't feel like a collective bargaining agreement that was signed between their employer and a third party doesn't work for them. Senator, I would refer back to a conversation that you and I had on the night of the inauguration. Mm-hmm. And we were talking specific. I think you know which conversation I'm talking about.
I do.
And we were not talking about particular laws that we would discuss or not discuss or pass or not pass. We were talking about broad themes of the types of legislation that we felt the General Assembly should be supporting. And there was one thing that we both agreed on, and that was the pursuit of legislation that would help the population in Missouri start to grow competitively with other states. And we made the case, and I forget if you said it or if I said it, so forgive me. We made the
case. Wife would be able to tell us, because she was bored to tears listening.
Yes, of course, of course. But we talked about any time you have a population that is growing, the new human beings and individuals that are coming into that society and that culture are bringing with them investment money and skill sets and new ideas and all the things that cause an economy to take off, all the things that cause jobs to become available, all the things that cause wages to go up ultimately in the future. And I think that one of the policies that we're discussing here tonight, now you and I happen to have a different perspective on the ultimate effect of this particular piece of legislation, but I do appreciate the fact that ultimately, we're ultimately going for the same goal, which is to get population growing. And unfortunately, in the state of Missouri, we haven't seen that growth.
No, we lost the congressional seat.
And so of all the laws that have been passed in the state of Missouri over the past 10 years, we haven't found the right ones that are really going to help the state grow. And so I'm always looking through possible legislation through the lens of liberty, because I believe the less that government will interfere with what the private sector is doing, the more the economy will grow. And this can apply to a variety of issues, whether it's labor reform, whether it's taxes, whatever it is. I think that's a worthwhile discussion, and I'm happy to have this inquiry.
Okay, one last question for you, and then I'm going to thank you for your inquiry. You said that in your race, and this is going to be a tough one for you, you said in your race, right to work was an issue. And I know who you ran against, who your opponent was, and I know her position on right to work. That was a pretty close race in the end, wasn't it?
It was.
I mean, it was a percent here or there?
I think it was 1.5%, very close.
1.5%, very close. So if you look at a pie of your district, and you say, you know, your district is, what do you think your RPI is, your Republican Performance Index? Probably 55, 57?
It's difficult to say. I would estimate between 57 and 59.
Okay. We'll just say 60. So 60% of your district is Republican. And this issue was a primary issue in your race that produced a 50-50 result. And then we can assume that the other 40% in the pie are against right to work. So don't you think that that would necessarily represent that you're representing a quarter of your district when you are saying that your district favors right to work?
No, I don't think that, and I'll say it for two reasons. One, because as you can imagine, we pulled this particular issue repeatedly to get feedback from the folks on how they felt about this particular issue. And I'll also say, in an environment where we have open primaries, I will tell you, I'm fond of saying in my primary that not only did, in our Republican primary, not only did the Republicans have a lot to say in that primary, many Democrats had a lot to say in that primary as well. So from that perspective, I think that the results in my primary in particular were far more representative of the district as a whole than you might think.
But you can't blame me for bringing it up.
Of course not, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. President.
Senator from the 7th.
I'd be remiss if I didn't inquire the Senator from the 26th.
Senator from the 26th. Senator from Franklin, do you yield?
I do.
Proceed.
Senator.
Good evening.
Our two new members did very good tonight in articulating their position, but I still don't feel like I got the exact answer that makes me change my mind on this legislation. So I'm going to leave it up to a veteran such as yourself to try. My question is very simple. A business says that we've heard time and time again that the reason why we're doing this is because businesses won't move here unless it's right to work. And my question to you is, what benefit does that business get
if we are right to work? What does this policy produce for that business if, either way, whether we're right to work or not, is it lower wages? Is that what they're looking for? Are they looking to save labor costs?
I don't necessarily think that's the case.
But what do they get? What is the benefit to them?
Obviously, I think in the conversation you just had, I think it was pretty well expressed. But I do think that when you look at companies that are willing or contemplating making a major investment, maybe multiple millions of dollars in either building a facility, a manufacturing facility in a state, I think the labor climate that exists is a factor that makes a determination.
But talking about that climate, what does that look like? What is it, difficult negotiation?
I think it's a less hostile climate where there is an opportunity for workers to have a choice. I believe presents a less hostile work climate that employers obviously probably embrace more because of that. I can't tell you every specific reason why.
Now, is it hostile, and I'm not asking you to, but is it hostile because at the end of the day, in order for them to get the labor to do what they want, they have to pay more for it? What is the hostility? I mean, I can't imagine that.
I think it's the third-party interference that potentially is a factor. I believe that creates more of a hostile labor climate and influence. And I think that one thing businesses want, they want a degree of certainty. And if they believe, again, it may be a manufactured belief, but I think what we've seen historically is that businesses have chose states that have right-to-work provisions passed to locate. I don't think we can ignore that, and we've missed many opportunities for that. But, again, I can't tell you all the specifics of what every part of that, but I do think that the conversation, the third-party influence, and having a opportunity there to have a friendlier labor climate is what's attractive to them.
Have you ever seen the symbolic gesture of taking a book of wood matches and breaking one of them and then taking the entire matchbox and trying to break all of them together? You think it's possible that they don't want to have the matches together because it's harder to break and that they would want to separate them out so they can break one at a time?
No, I don't think that occurs. It doesn't prohibit someone's ability to be every matchstick being in the box.
But when we look historically, from the historical perspective, the robber barons of the 1880s, 1890s, into the 1900s, really before my hero Teddy Roosevelt got in charge of the country, and he essentially told the robber barons, "Your time is up." He called Carnegie and Rockefeller and all of them and said, "It's over. Square deal for every man." Before he did that, the wealth disparity, the working conditions, the working hours, all of the things that those robber barons were taking advantage of, it was because they could break those matchsticks one at a time. And the labor unions were organized and formed so that those matchsticks would sit side by side together and be harder to break. Now, is it possible, and I won't argue, that they've gone too far in some cases, that their demands have been unreasonable in others, and have led to the perception that they have outlived their usefulness because of our modern communication system?
I think we have regulatory agencies and rule and things that are in place now that weren't in play back then that have
but the reason why it feels that way, the reason why it feels that way is because of the success that they've generated with OSHA, the success that they generated with the weekend, the success they generated with the 40-hour work week. All of the successes that they had makes us feel like that they're no longer necessary. But my question to you is that if we make a concerted effort to separate those matches and they start getting broke one at a time again, don't we risk reverting back to that innate nature of greed that the robber barons was a guiding principle for in the late 1800s? Don't we risk that?
I don't believe. But how do you explain the phenomenon of the Indiana union participation and labor percentage rising after the passage of Right to Work?
Because I mean, and I think in the model, you've not seen this fracturing off and little by little, one by one, breaking those matchsticks, because that just hasn't occurred. Again, that's a fear tactic. Yeah, it hasn't occurred yet. But the reality is that when you look at that, explain that to me. How can you explain that union membership has continued to grow and thrive in those states that have passed right-to-work legislation?
I just think...
Because I'll give you one answer, if you'd like.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
because
yeah,
I will say this. Because businesses have came, there's been more jobs created, there's been more growth, there's been more opportunity for all those unions to thrive and employ more members because of the growth that's occurred in those states. That's one element as to why you've seen union membership increase, is because those states are outperforming, outproducing states like Missouri.
But we agree that it's only 8% of the workforce. So why is 8% of the workforce that I don't hear from the workforce themselves wanting this change, why is it now our number one priority? That's the first thing that we trot out here.
I think that, you know, in the this is my seventh year in the legislature, I think that we've continued to this be a major battle that we've seen, again, probably not to the extent where we have gotten this being the priority issue, moved it to the forefront, but obviously it's one of the governor's priorities. He ran on that being a fact that he would sign.
Did he have a choice if he was going to run in a Republican primary? Did he have a choice and have any hope of success? Because of the framing, because of the donor bases, because of this issue being the golden calf of the Republican agenda, did he have a choice?
I guess he did have a choice. I mean, I would hope
could have not ran as a Republican.
His ideology would lead him to believe that obviously the freedom of a worker to choose whether he wants to belong to a union or not. I think that in the very framing of anyone's core belief should be that should be right, that employees should have the ability to choose.
Okay, what about freedom of the employer to be free of criminal charges? Why are you placing criminal charges or the potential for criminal charges on an employer who does want to do work with a union-only shop?
I'm not sure how those criminal charges are going to occur. And again,
well, the provisions are in here.
Well, I understand, but in the context of where you've in this conversation, that we've talked about the fact that if you are an employer and you want to hire someone that has the level of training, I think nothing prohibits you from hiring those individuals that have that level of training.
But we're prohibiting the organization that has that training from collecting the money that makes that training possible.
Well, but again, now maybe the model has to change, you know, slightly from what it is before. There maybe you can continue to provide that level of training, but not in the same mechanism that you have. The senator from St. Charles had said that he visited the 513 Training Center. I myself have been to the 513 Training Center. My best man in my wedding runs that 513 Training Center. I believe they provide an excellent opportunity in training.
Does he support Right to Work, just out of curiosity?
Does he support it?
Yeah.
No, and again...
Have you met any rank-and-file members of unions that support Right to Work?
I
haven't in 10 years.
I don't know. I mean, I know that there are some probably that haven't vocalized that, but I do know that there probably are some that exist that probably are going to enjoy that freedom to be able to choose.
Choose not to pay? I bet a lot of them will enjoy the freedom not to pay. The problem will be is when they have the freedom not to get trained, and then they have the freedom not to get hired.
But that training model, again, I said that there can be some adaptation to that training model. Obviously, they provide that training at no cost. To anyone that wants to enter that facility, obviously, there's an application process. They have to show up. They have to be there every day. They have to be on time. But again, that model that works right now that they're using maybe have to adapt it to provide that training. I do believe that
because it's broke, because the model right now is
no,
broke?
No, I don't think the model is broke. But again, if you look at the employers that utilize that training facility, they've been able, again, I don't know if it's all dues paid or if some of the employers that employ workers from that local 513 also supplement that training facility. But they like to have that training facility because obviously it provides them workers to come out of there with certain skills. That model may have to change and be tweaked, but it doesn't mean that it has to end with this passage of this legislation.
Senator, I'm always appreciative to talk to you. Mr. President?
Senator from the 7th.
Wire the senator from the 17th.
Senator from the 17th. Senator from Clay, do yield?
I do.
Proceed.
What you doing? I was listening to your inquiry of the last few senators.
Well, then
go ahead.
Well, then you heard that it wasn't the most important issue in the senator from the 21st race, that it was an important issue in the senator from the 23rd race, and that was a very close race, of a point and a half. And we talked about where the union members are located, and I brought up your district has a large number of union members. And I made the statement that in the last 10 years, I cannot remember one time a rank-and-file union member coming up to me saying, hey, man, you know what? I really just don't want to pay my dues. Can you pass that right to work so I don't have to pay? Not one time in 10 years. The senator from the 26th says, yeah, it's possible that they're out there, but didn't really have a specific example of when that's happened. So having a large number of union members in your district, have you ever had someone come up at an event and say, I don't want to pay my dues?
No. I mean, they're very, very largely against this proposal. One thing I did want to say, and I don't see, I was listening to your inquiry of the senator from the 23rd, and I don't see him still in here, so I hope he's listening, but there seems to have been a fundamental misunderstanding of how the law actually works. Because during your inquiry, there was a discussion about how, well, if workers didn't pay their dues, if there was a contract and workers didn't pay their dues, then they would not be protected by the contract.
Right. He made it sound like they would individually negotiate for themselves.
Right. That's actually not how it works under federal labor law. Federal law comes in and says every worker that's covered by a contract, so like Ford, for instance. So Ford's the big employer in my district, right? So Ford negotiates with the UAW. If right to work passes, it's not as if people on the line who decide not to pay their dues then go negotiate their own contract with Ford. That's not how it works. Federal law says everyone is covered by the contract that's negotiated, whether or not they're a member of the union and whether or not they paid for it. So essentially what you're doing is you're giving people the protections that were negotiated without letting them pay for it. I mean, it's basically they're freeloading. And let's just be honest about it.
They're freeloading.
They're getting all the protections. In fact, I've told the advocates for this law for years that if it meant I can choose to be part of the collective bargaining unit and take that agreement, or I can choose to go to management on my own and negotiate my own deal, I'd be that for that 100%. 100% I'd be for that. If you want to take it on your own, or if you want to be part of a group and you make the choice, great. But what this does is it says if you go out and quit paying your dues, you don't get to go on your own. You get the same deal everybody else gets. You just didn't put anything into the system. And that's philosophically
un-American.
Not right. Like to me, particularly in my party, the idea that we're letting people get benefits that they didn't pay for is so fundamentally against the Republican Party, it blows
that
my mind.
Welfare, worker welfare?
Yeah. I mean, it fundamentally blows my mind that we say, hey, you know what? It'd be like this. It'd be like saying, hey, I am going to come up with a right to drive. You have a right to use all the roads in the state of Missouri.
Uh-oh. They don't like what you're saying, so they cut your mic.
Uh-oh. Hey, there we go. We're back.
Conspiracy.
I may need another mic this session before it's over, it sounds like. But let's say you have a right to drive, okay? You can use any road in the state, but you get to choose whether or not you pay gas tax. How do you think that would go over? You get to choose whether you pay for it, but whether you pay for it or not, you still get the benefits of the entire system.
How many people do you think would choose not to pay the gas tax?
Probably near 100%.
But what happens... Now, the senator from the 26th brought up that in Indiana they saw union membership increase. You think that that could possibly be a knee-jerk reaction to the fear associated with what happens when this law goes into effect?
I honestly don't know why. What I do know is that we can look at statistics a number of ways, and we can project our ideas of why they are what they are. But I don't know why. I haven't seen the studies. I honestly don't know why.
So we're getting ready to pass a freeloader bill.
So here's the other thing, though, I want to go back to. You know, we talk about, it's supposed to be this idea that we're going to get all these jobs, right? All these jobs are going to flood in. You know, all these site selectors that look at all these places to go, they skip over Missouri because we're not right to work. And I thought you asked a very good fundamental question of why that is. And nobody would give you the straight answer, but the straight answer is lower labor costs. Like, why else would it? I mean, right. there's really no other answer. It's lower labor costs.
Well, I also asked the question. Go ahead.
But we've already tested this in the real world in Missouri. You remember a couple of sessions ago, we had a special session over Boeing.
Yep.
Right? So what happened in that session? We had the workers, the machinist union in Seattle gets into a dispute with the management at Boeing. They can't reach an agreement on the contract. So Boeing says, hey, guess what? Okay, we're not going to worry with your contract anymore. We're going to look for other places to locate our line. And they started shopping, and it was very public. We had to come back in a special session to put together a package of incentives, tax incentives and various other deals, to try and lure Boeing to start building planes in St. Louis. Another state that was in that mix was South Carolina. South Carolina is a right-to-work state. South Carolina already has a Boeing line. You would think that if right-to-work was so important in manufacturing that Boeing wouldn't have even been a contest. They would have left Seattle and they would have located and expanded their line in South Carolina because they're right-to-work. But what in fact happened was they didn't pick South Carolina. They didn't pick Missouri. They went back to the very union that they had the disagreement with in the first place, and they stayed in Seattle. So if right to work was really that big of a magnet, why didn't it work in that situation? What was it that made them go back to the same union they had the original dispute with instead of expanding their line in South Carolina?
So, and I don't have the answer to that question. I would suggest
But we all lived it. We all went right through that situation, and everybody pretends like, well, it's going to make a huge difference.
Well, and apparently Boeing decided that the quality of labor that they were getting where they were at was important to them, and that's why they chose to stay. But let's take some logic a little further here. So we agree that the companies that are looking for right-to-work states, that this particular policy that's in front of us is somehow going to benefit them so much that they're going to choose that policy over a state that doesn't have that policy. And we said, what do they get in return for it? Your answer was lower wages, savings on labor costs. The senator from the 26th said they get a less hostile work negotiation. I brought up the matches, all the matches together versus snapping one individually. So if we haven't heard from rank and file that want this, and we haven't heard from the 92% that are not the 8% unionized that have made this a big deal, if it failed in 1978 with 70-some percent against, if we saw a poll yesterday or 2 days ago that had it at losing 36-49, who wants this? Where's the individuals who are pushing this to be a part of the agenda that have the resources necessary to punish members of the Republican Party who do not go along with this legislation? Those interests, why do they want it?
I assume it's because they want lower labor costs.
So lower labor costs equal less quality of life. What would be the benefit of that?
Higher profit margin. I think we are going to have to get another mic at some point because it keeps cutting out. But
so and I asked the senator from the 26th said that the governor Greitens he ran with this, and I made the contention that he didn't have a choice. Rather, he thinks it's a great idea or not. It's such a purity test now in the Republican Party that if you're not for it, somehow you're not a Republican. Have you ever felt like that it's punitive to have a position that the interests that are funding the party don't want you to have?
There's certainly a lot of pressure. I mean, there's certainly a lot of pressure for, within a party, within either party, to have certain positions on any issue, right? I mean, there's certainly that pressure. And it comes to, in your party, too. I'm sure there are issues.
Right.
In positions that, somehow we've gotten in America to think today that it's completely red and blue, that it's completely 100% you're with me or 100% you're against me. I've never looked at it like that. I've looked at parties as a collective of ideas, right? And if you believe in most of the ideas, then that's who you should associate with. But to think that, you know, you have to be 100% pure on every single thing, I mean, that's just silly to me.
And you staked out a position against this in 2015.
I staked out a position against it in 2006.
2006. So, but you were really forced as a senator.
2005, probably. But
wait, was it 2014 that we, or was it 2015 that we actually they used the previous question to get this bill through and on the governor's desk? Was that 15 or 14? Remember?
Okay. 15.
Okay. 15. All right. So 2015.
Yeah.
2015.
Right. We moved the previous question.
They moved the previous question. They shut down debate.
Right.
They moved this legislation through to the governor.
Right.
You voted no.
Right.
The governor vetoed it. You voted no on the override.
Right.
I watched as there were punitive measures levied against you from the interests that want this to pass, and then you won your race with 61% of the vote.
I did. I mean, there's no question where my district is on this. There's zero question in my mind where this district is. You know, I've represented this area for, this is my 13th year now. My entire House district is within the 17th senatorial district. So these are people that I know very, very well. And there's no question in my mind. In fact, if you want to talk the politics of it, there was one House race within my Senate district this year that right to work became a major issue. Okay, in the general election. It was in the primary and then it was in the general. In fact, in the primary, the candidate that was for right to work beat the incumbent in the House who had voted against it. Okay? It was basically a single issue race.
Right.
So in the primary, this person that was for right to work won. In the general, it became a major issue, as you can imagine, and this is actually an area over near the Ford plant. So there's a lot of labor families in this area. I, of course, am against it. This candidate was for it. In the precincts that we share, 100% of the precincts, because there are a couple that split in the House districts, you know, where they don't represent the whole precinct. In the districts where we represent 100% of the precinct, I received 3,500 more votes than that candidate in the general election. So you can tell very clearly in the general election that this was a major issue. 3,500, you know how, I mean, that's a lot of votes in a House race.
That is a lot of votes.
3,500. And that's the only real difference between the two was our positions on that issue as far as the campaign goes.
So out of all the priorities that we face, economic development, education, public safety, all the issues that we face, this is what they've chosen to be their top priority. Number one issue that we're debating on this floor. Why?
Senator, I'm not in leadership. I'm not making that decision.
But I'm trying to logically figure out what makes this issue, because it's almost like George Lakoff's Don't Think of an Elephant.
So,
it's the framing of it.
So you could probably make the argument that this is an issue that we've legislated before. Right, we've gone through this debate, as you mentioned in 2015. We've moved the previous question. We've cut off debate. It's gone to the governor's desk. He's vetoed it. It's been back. This is nothing new. It is something that there are certain elements of the chamber that have been trying to do for a long time. There's no question. Now that we have a governor who has said that he would sign it, it makes sense that you would kind of clear out if you're coming from a hostile administration to a friendly administration, not just on this issue, but on a couple of other issues. To me, it makes sense that you would move the things that have been stopped by the previous administration. This is one of those things, so I would give them that that's probably what they're thinking.
I do not believe it's the top priority that our state faces, and I would suggest that we get to work on.
Well, I don't agree that it's our top priority. You asked why I thought it was the first thing.
So one of the last questions I got, because I've had the floor for a while now, and I know some other senators want to speak. We saw a report the other day that Kansas lost, what was it, 94,000 jobs?
9,400 jobs in the last 12 months.
Okay, so they've lost 9,400 jobs.
In the last 12 months.
Is Kansas a right-to-work state?
It is a right-to-work state.
How in the world did Kansas lose 9,400 jobs?
I thought it was fake news. I thought it was fake news when I read it.
Oh, right? You thought it was fake news.
Oh, it has to be, right?
It has to be fake news.
It creates all the jobs that you can't...
Because everything that we've heard from the proponents of this legislation is that, man, as soon as the ink dries on the governor's signature, that we're going to be beating them away. We're going to use a Trumpism.
Those
we're going to be winning so much, we're going to want to stop winning.
Those might be alternative facts. Maybe that's what we're...
We should start an alternative fact discussion.
I mean, it could be. It could be.
Well, Senator, I know it's important to your district. It proved out in the election how important it was to your district. You and I have talked about some of the motivations for this legislation, and I think that it's only fair that we air them out in the public so that way everyone understands. I offered a referendum clause to sit this to a vote of the people.
Which I voted for.
If it's that important, if it's that popular, if it's that great, if it's going to do so many wonderful things for the state of Missouri, then the people should vote for it overwhelmingly. Overwhelmingly. If you ran on this issue and you had a tremendous electoral success in November, then it should be a slam dunk. But yet, it was defeated. It was defeated. So, they don't want the people to decide. Because maybe the people don't think it's such a good idea. Thank you, Senator. Right.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Clay, for what purpose do you rise? Senator from the 23rd is not in the chamber. Sergeant at Arms, could you summon the senator from the 23rd?
Check, check. All
right. Thank you.
Senator from the 23rd, do you yield to an inquiry from the senator from Clay?
I do, Mr. President.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Senator, for coming in to take my inquiry. I don't know if you heard the beginning of my inquiry or the senator's inquiry, the 7th, with me just a few minutes ago.
I did not. I apologize.
Okay, no problem. I was listening to your inquiry or to his inquiry of you in my office prior to coming out here myself. One of the things that you all covered was you had made a comment along the lines of you didn't believe that if there was a contract and someone chose not to be a member of the union or exercised their right to work, chose not to pay their dues, that they would then, it was your understanding that they would then negotiate their own contract or they would not be under the collective bargaining agreement. Is that
it's my understanding that the state of Missouri does allow for members-only agreements, which would allow collective bargaining agreements to only cover those members which are members of the union that's being covered. Yes.
So how do we do that when federal labor law says that a contract must cover all employees, whether they're in a union or not?
Well, I believe that the Supreme Court has ruled on multiple occasions that members-only agreements are lawful and within legal bounds.
So do you have any cases to cite or anything? Because I'm under the impression that federal law says every member is covered.
I do, Senator, and if you'll give me just a couple minutes, I will.
We can talk about it offline. I didn't bring you out here to try and dress you down or anything.
I just am
completely on. Federal labor law says you have to cover every member of the unit, whether they pay dues or not, whether they're in a member of a union or not. I would be interested to see if there's some case law or something to the contrary. So we can talk about it offline.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Senator from Phelps.
Thank you, Mr. President. To speak on the amendment, I'm going to have to ask my members to vote no on this amendment. I've had discussion with a number of members in the caucus, and I feel that this is really an important part. So I would ask my colleagues to vote no on the amendment that's on the floor. Thank you.
Further discussion. Senator from the 13th. You are recognized to close on Senate Amendment 1. I'm sorry, Senate Amendment number 3 to Senate Substitute number 2 for Senate Bill 19.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, once again, I think this is a good amendment, and it would give some alleviation to contractors that are not, they're not going to be breaking the laws that we make here, not intentionally. And as I said before, I'd like to get to a place in this chamber where we're not penalizing good contractors throughout the state, good employers. So I urge the body to support this amendment. And if I could get five members standing, I ask for a roll call. Four or five.
You have five members standing. You shall get a roll call.
Thank you, Mr. President. I close.
The senator from the 13th has moved the adoption of Amendment Number 3 to Senate Substitute Number 2 for Senate Bill 19. Madam Secretary, call the roll.
Senators Brown, Chappelle Nadal, Cunningham, Curls, Dixon, Igel, Emery, Hageman, Holzman, Hoskins, Hummel, Kehoe, Koenig, Kraus, Leibola, Munslinger, Nasheed, Onder, Richard, Riddle, Rizzo, Romine, Rowden, Sater, Schaaf, Schatz, Shoup, Sifton, Sylvie, Wallingford, Walsh, Wasson, Whelan.
Senator from the 23rd votes no. Senator from the 5th. You are not recorded, Senator. Votes yes. Senator from the 14th. Votes aye. Senator from Green. Votes no. By a vote of 12 ayes and 20 noes, you have rejected Senate Amendment Number 3. Further discussion. Senator from the 5th, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. I would like to inquire the Senator from the 7th.
Senator from the 7th, do you yield? Senator from the 7th.
I do.
Proceed.
Thank you, Senator.
Good evening, Senator. How are you? I'm doing well. I just got done talking to a few of our colleagues. And
you know, you talk a lot this evening. And the things that you discussed on this floor was very relevant and prevalent to today's history and where we are and where we have come from. Okay?
Okay.
I just want to commend you for standing up and fighting for those that cannot fight for themselves. You know.
Wait, I thought you were the voice for the voiceless.
Yeah, I am that. Yeah, don't take that, okay? That's my slogan. Don't ever take that. You know, but Senator, I want to say that you truly understand the dynamics of what's happening here in the state of Missouri when it comes to right to work. You actually get it. You understand that at the end of the day, those individuals that are working within the unions will have less protection. Isn't that true to say?
Yeah, yeah.
You understand that at the end of the day, that those individuals, even though they can keep a little money in their pockets, that they will never have the collective bargaining agreements that sets them free when it comes to their work placement.
Keep speaking.
The question that I pose to you today is this here.
Yeah.
We have Republicans. Mm-hmm. Mr. President.
Senator from the Fifth.
It's way too noisy in here, okay? So get it right for me.
Well, let's have some order in the chamber so the debate can be heard by all.
Mr. President, that was like really extremely weak, so if you can gavel that down a little harder so they can really understand what you're trying to say to them, that would be great.
Next time, Senator.
Thank you. So, Senator from the Seventh, the bill that we're working on tonight, can you articulate to Missourians what that would do in terms of a negative impact for working Missourians here in the state of Missouri?
I will try in very one sentence. It will disincentivize the shared burden that generates the protection that they receive in compensation and in work safety standards.
That was well articulated, and that's a fact. That's a fact that those individuals who are working every single day, who have cultivated this country by way of labor, will be obsolete. Those individuals will have no protection when it comes to labor rights. Those individuals will not have the type of structure that's needed for them to be able to pay into their wages, because what the Republicans are saying is that you don't have to pay into those wages. You don't have to pay into the union wages simply because we don't want you to, because we don't want you to have protection. We want the corporations to be able to protect you. No, not protect you, but to serve you in a way that you have no protection.
Let me ask you this, Senator. Why do you think a professional athlete choose to go with a manager or an attorney, a sports manager, to write their contract for them? Why do you think that? Because it costs money. They have to give some of their contract to an agent. That's the word I was looking for. To a sports agent to negotiate their contract with the team. Why do you think they do that?
They do it because they have a sense of protection when it comes to their monies and how they do business.
And because that agent knows they're trained what to look for in the contracts? They're trained to know what to ask for in terms of the benefits that athlete is going to get?
Absolutely.
That's their job. And you know what? Those agents make good money, but so does the athlete. The athlete gets a better contract because they have some. Why do you think all the agents want, or why do you think all the athletes want Scott Boras in the Major League Baseball to represent them?
Because he negotiates their plan.
Because he gets better contracts.
And he gets better contracts when it comes to how they move forward.
You think Scott Boras would continue to negotiate for that player if all of a sudden they didn't have to pay them the percentage of their fee? You think he would continue to negotiate on their behalf if they said, you know what, I want you to negotiate for me. I want you to give me the best contract you can, and then I'm not going to pay you your fee.
I think that the unions, they hear from individuals, right? They hear from individuals, some of their constituents that may say, You know, we don't want to be in a union. You know, we don't want to take our monies and put it towards union dues. We want to keep those dollars in our pockets, okay? But what they don't understand, at the end of the day, is when that union, when that company decides to lay them off, they have no protection. When that company decides to say that we don't want to pay you a livable wage, we want to pay you a wage that is minimal, they don't have that protection to go and negotiate. They don't understand that.
They become single matches, easily broke.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you and I know what this is about. This is about dismantling the union movement as we know it. Because the Republicans, some of the Republicans, yeah. Not all Republicans,
not all.
But
not
some
all.
Of the Republicans believe that the union movement shifts towards the Democratic Party. But what they don't know is that the union movement in the state of Missouri has many Republicans members in their party that they're not willing to protect. They're not willing to protect the Republicans that are within the union movement. They think that they're undermining and destroying the union movement because it's a Democratic movement. And it's not a Democratic movement.
Well,
it's
recently,
a Republican / Democratic movement.
Well, recently we have seen the Republican Party come up with almost like a purity test. If you're not for right to work, then you're not a Republican, and they've had wealthy donors invest large sums of money, trying to eradicate the wing of the party that is friendly to labor. I mean, Representative Salone was defeated in a primary specifically, directly, because of resources from a wealthy individual who did not like her vote on right to work.
But at the end of the day, though, you have Republicans who are a part of the union movement in the state of Missouri that truly understands that so goes right to work, so goes their protections. Isn't that true to say?
Well, I think that it sets up a condition by which the deterioration of the support for those that collect the bargaining sets in motion. So maybe not tomorrow, and maybe in Indiana they've seen a real brief spike, but over the long run, we're talking, you know, these policies exist long after we are gone. In the long run, if you do not require people to pay for something, whatever that is, loses value. And if the skill set of a negotiator to collectively bargain on behalf of a labor union can no longer be afforded, if the training that is set up by the labor unions, I mentioned the carpenters earlier, they have a wonderful facility in Independence along I-70. They have under one roof many training stations, welding, building all sorts of variety of use of materials. That training gives someone who has no previous history of trades work the opportunity to learn a craft to provide a good living for their family. And when you say that you no longer have an obligation to pay into that system, then that system ultimately will degrade.
No, what the Republican Party is saying, they're saying that you shouldn't be obligated to pay into that system. They're saying that there shouldn't be a mandate for you to pay into that system. And what we're saying is that there should be a mandate for you to pay into that system.
No, hold on.
And the reason that we say that is simply because not that we want their funds.
We don't like welfare.
Not that we want their
funds. We don't like freeloaders.
We're saying it because they have protection. And they're paying into protection under the law. Those individuals can no longer be fired without arbitration. Those individuals cannot be on the sideline and not get the jobs because simply they're not being able to have the representation that's needed in order to protect their jobs and their stability. That's what right to work yields. And what the Republicans are saying is that, no, you don't have to have right to work. You don't have to pay into these dues in order to get the protection that you need. You can have more money in your pocket. But at the end of the day, yes, the Republicans are right. You can have more money in your pocket as a worker. But at the end of the day, if you get fired by a corporation, you have no protection under the rights to be able to go in and say that this is unfair treatment. You have no one to protect you. So the question is, do we want more money in the pockets of individuals? Or do we want to protect people's right to work?
Well, Senator, I would say penny wise, pound foolish. You may have that $1,200 in your pocket for that year, but the next time that contract comes up and you don't have somebody negotiating on your behalf, that money that you have to pay into that will be less. The safety conditions will be less.
That's right.
And I think, answer my own question. I asked the question, what is it about this policy that makes companies want to be in a state that has this policy? And we didn't really get a very clear answer. The senator from the 17th came the closest with lower labor wages. But I will tell you that I think they want this policy because ultimately it makes it easier to take advantage of the worker.
That's right. You are absolutely right. You just hit the hammer on the nail. And
I'm not even trained to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know that too. Yeah, right. So, you know, Senator, you know, we have seen studies, and I've studied the different dynamics throughout the states, and states with right-to-work laws have lower wages and income. Did you know that? This is a study. This is something that I've studied, right?
Yep.
Okay, so on the average, workers in states with right-to-work laws makes $6,109 a year less annual than those who live and work in non-right-to-work states. That's a fact.
Unless it's an alternative fact.
You know what? Some people come to me and they say, oh, yeah, Senator, look at Texas. Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a right-to-work state.
I believe it.
Texas is a right-to-work state.
So is Kansas.
And they say, oh, Senator, you know, look what's happening in Texas. And what I say to them is this. You cannot compare Texas being a right-to-work state while Texas is an oil state. Oil state. It's an oil state. The oil is what keeps those wages down, not right-to-work.
Well, as the senator from the 17th pointed out, and I hadn't even thought of it, but it's an excellent example, why didn't Boeing choose South Carolina? They were a right-to-work state. Why did they stay in Washington when they had the choice? They could have moved. They could have moved to a right-to-work state and taken that line there, but they didn't. Why?
So you ready to go home?
Are you ready to go home?
Yeah.
Well, it's on Thursday afternoon sometime.
If I sit down, you can go home.
Saturday. I'm good.
That's what I just heard.
What's that?
If I sit down, you can go home. We'll be done.
Well, if they lay the bill over, that'd be great.
I'm not done. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
I would like to inquire the senator from the... sit down, Senator. Not ready for you. I would like to inquire the senator from the 9th.
Senator from the 9th, do you yield to the senator from the 5th?
I do.
Proceed.
Unfortunately, Senator, I'm not about to make this night comfortable for those that are trying to inflict and infuse injustice to the state of Missouri when it comes to right to work. So, Senator.
Yes.
How are you doing this evening?
I'm okay. Just
I wanted to inquire of you because I found a quote. And this quote dates back to approximately, 56 years ago. 56 years ago.
Oh, wow.
This is the quote that Dr. Martin Luther King quoted 56 years ago. And I quote, Mr. President, it's
Senator
way too
Fifth.
Noisy in here for me. Can you? Yeah, please. Thank you.
How is that, Senator?
Yeah, thank
Let's
you.
Let's have order in the chamber so the senators can hear each other's inquiry. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. So, Senator, you know Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh, of course.
Tell me about Dr. Martin Luther King. What was that guy like?
Well, I think we know the role he played in history.
Let's talk about the role, because everybody only think he knows about the I Have a Dream.
Right.
So talk about more than the I Have a Dream. What was Dr. Martin Luther King really about? You know.
Well, he was about civil rights, and he was a very powerful advocate for workers' rights as well. And so I think you're referring to a speech you said in 1961.
No. Just talk to me about him. We don't have to talk about his speech. Just talk about what type of guy he was and who he was without the I Have a Dream speech. Do you know anything about him?
Well, I think many of us do. I mean, I think we know that he was a very powerful advocate for the civil rights of people. He was very passionate about equality. Many of those issues that we're talking about in this issue and issues that certainly pervade far beyond even what we're talking about today. So I think many of us recognize the contribution that Dr. King made, in history. And so, as well as when we talk about, of course, the contributions that he's made, and as much as he was a very powerful advocate, as I said, for equality and some of those other things, which we know, he also had those very same strong thoughts in regards to workers' rights as well. So.
Absolutely. Thanks for getting me there. So, Senator, I would just like to quote Dr. Martin Luther King, okay? And, Senator.
Yes.
This is 2017?
Right, it is.
This was 1961, meaning that we're dealing with an issue that he discussed 56 years ago.
Right.
This is 56 years ago.
Right.
And I quote, in our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fought against false slogans. Fueled against false slogans.
Fueled by false slogans.
Okay.
Yeah.
Such as, and I quote, we must guard against being fueled against false slogans, such as right to work. It is a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights.
Right.
Its purpose is to destroy the labor union movement and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions for everyone.
Right.
Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights. We do not intend to let them do this to us. to let them do this to us. We demand this fraud be stopped. Our weapon is our vote. Our weapon is our voice. This is what Dr. Martin Luther King said in 1961. So how is it that we stand here tonight and not continue to fight the legacy of the man whose shoulders we stand on? This is appalling. This is a movement that is destroying the human rights of America. This is not the Republic. This is not democracy. People should have the right to join unions in a manner in which they see fit that represents their interests. How dare Republicans, those that feel a threat to the political movement, stop the people who they serve? This is not about Democrat or Republican. This is about democracy. This is about the United States Republic. Individuals having the right to choose and to do as they see fit when it comes to their working conditions. It's wrong. It's not right. And it's American.
Right. I think he said something very powerful in not being fooled by false slogans of right to work. As you said, he said, it is a law that robs us of our civil rights and our job rights. And, you know, we know that he was a very powerful advocate for workers' rights.
56 years ago!
6 years ago.
Right. And here we are in 2017, still dealing with the argument and the fight that Dr. Martin Luther King stood on
right. And
fought for. And we're right back here today, as if the clock has been turned back decades.
Yeah, he basically said, of course, the right to work robs us of our civil rights and our job rights, and basically denies us our right for equal job opportunities. And I agree. I mean, we're here 56 years later, and, you know, we have the same issue with this right to work issue. And it is a civil rights issue.
Senator, let me say this here.
It is.
You know what? The Republicans, they have their philosophical views on what should be policy in this state, right?
Of course, right.
And the Democrats, we have less power, but we can agitate, we can advocate, and we can aggravate, okay, in this chamber, okay? But at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, how do we get here? You have Democrats who voted for Republicans. We have Democrat union members who voted for Republicans, not even thinking about their own bottom line, but thinking about the fact that they didn't like Barack Obama, right. And they don't like a woman ruling the world. So at the end of the day, we're going to go Republican, and we're going to vote Republican. Even though we're Democrats, we're going to vote Republican because at the end of the day, we can't get with the fact of a woman controlling our destiny. And then they go with the Democrat destroying their destiny.
You know, but you say that the Democrats voting Republican. The reality is I'm not sure that even some of those were really even Democrats. I mean, the reality is that we're here on an agenda that really hurts many of the workers that happens to typically have the same philosophy. And I think you're right. I think they're not necessarily thinking of how it affects them. In the future, when we talk about economic equality, when we talk about job opportunity, when we talk about workers' benefits. You know, in many of the right-to-work states, they tend to have more unions, of course, that don't have health care. They don't have pensions. So we find that to be more prevalent in areas where we have right-to-work states. And so I think that, you know, in as much as we say that they're Democrats that have voted Republicans, I think that did I hear one time that there may be upwards in some unions of almost 28% happen to be Republican? And so we do have a differing opinion.
I'm sorry, Senator. Mr. President.
Senator from the 5th.
Unfortunately, I notice the absence of a quorum.
Senator from the 5th notes an absence of a quorum. Sergeant Arms, ring the bell.
I'm about to play.
A quorum has been established. Senator from the 5th, proceed with your inquiry.
Mr. President, okay? Senator? Continue the inquiry. So.
Okay.
Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. Do you have anything else you want to discuss with me? Because I'm ready to go to the next senator.
Oh, are you? Okay. Feel free to go to the next senator.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. President.
Senator from the 5th.
I would like to go to the senator from, inquire the senator from the 16th.
Senator from the 16th. Senator from Phelps, do you yield?
I do.
Senator, good evening. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Senator, so, you know, if you can just convince me, because I may vote with you. Who knows?
I think you're seeing a lot.
Listen, I may just vote with you. If you can convince me why there's a need for this particular piece of legislation to be implemented in statute here in the state of Missouri, I may just support your bill. So tell me, why do you feel that this bill works in the best interest of working Missourians, mm-hmm. Missourians in the state of Missouri?
Okay. If you were here when I presented the bill to start with?
I wasn't.
You was not? Why would you miss such an important bill?
You know what? Because this bill is ridiculous.
No.
Okay, absolutely. And I have some more important business to deal with.
That's your.
And so I figure that, being that this is your bill, that even though I felt that this bill was a ridiculous bill, that this bill should not be on this floor, that when I came back in this chamber, you would tell me why you felt a need to present this bill.
Okay. Now, I'll start from the beginning. There's 27 states in the United States now that are right to work.
Okay.
And we would become the 28th state if this bill, in fact, passes this floor and goes to the House and passes and goes to the governor's desk, and he signs it.
Okay.
Now, why is that important today? Missouri is losing population. Missouri does not appear to be competitive with our surrounding states. Everyone is right to work. But Illinois, and as I said in my opening remarks, 25 years ago, right to work was a real leg up on getting some of these companies, Nissan, Toyota, BMW, all these companies. And Now it's just a matter of survival. In other words, it kind of levels the playing field. Or we continue to lose congressional seats, we continue to lose
jobs. Who is we?
Jobs.
Who is we?
The people of the state of Missouri.
Who are the people? It's Democrats or Republicans? Who is we?
Both. Both.
Okay.
I don't think that jobs look at whether or not you're a Democrat or a Republican.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of arguments, both sides of the issue, which I said respectfully at the start of this, that, you know, I'm going to make my arguments on my side of the issue. You're going to make your arguments, or your caucus will make their arguments. And I understand the feeling that you have on some of these issues, but you also have to understand kind of where I'm coming from as well.
Senator, let me just say, for the record, you have a very soothing voice.
Well, I'm trying to soothe you.
You can almost put me to sleep.
Because you told me you were thinking about
voting. I like your voice, but I don't like your bill. You're doing a great job with the voice, but you're not. You're doing a horrible sign with the bill.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a really respectful, nice guy, and I always treat you really nicely.
I don't want to hold. I don't want you to help me filibuster your bill. So I just want to ask two more questions.
Okay.
And that question is, how many states that have implemented right to work that is flourishing in
all
a way that
them.
We have never seen before?
All of them.
Tell me, which ones?
Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, Tennessee. Alabama.
Let's use Texas.
Georgia.
Texas. Let's use Texas.
Well, and...
Oh, you're going to say Texas, right?
No, I wasn't. Because Texas is a unique situation, just like Florida's a unique situation, because Texas gets a lot of money from oil, Florida gets a lot of money from tourism. So I specifically left out some of those states and concentrated on states in the Midwest and the South that are growing.
Reason that they're growing is not because of right to work. You know that, right?
That's your opinion.
No, that's a fact.
Why would you
say? They're not growing because we have a right to work state. Give me one state that you think is growing because we have a right to work state in the state of Missouri. I mean, throughout the Midwest. And I'll argue the facts.
Okay. Oklahoma, Kansas. Anybody that surrounds
So tell me
right
this here. Oklahoma. What are their major consumer product?
Not much of anything.
Give me one thing.
Okay. Mr. President.
Senator from Phelps.
As bad as I hate to, because I thought I was really getting along here, would you please pace Senate Substitute 2 for Senate Bill 19 on the informal calendar, please?
That bill will be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from Cole.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to Senate bills for... No, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I read the wrong script. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of announcements.
Announcements.
Hey.
Order of business is announcements. Seeing none, Senator from Cole. Senator from the 5th. Senator from the 5th, you have an announcement.
Thank you, Mr. President. Tomorrow is the second annual Sex Trafficking Awareness Day in the Capitol. Just 2 years ago, I sponsored a piece of legislation that deals with sex trafficking here in the state of Missouri and throughout the city of St. Louis. And we passed that bill, okay? We have a very, very serious problem that individuals are not paying attention to, and that is sex trafficking here in the state of Missouri. Tomorrow, we're going to acknowledge the fact that we do have a problem by making tomorrow Sex Trafficking Awareness Day in the Capitol, and I would like for everyone to join, everyone to come out and the rotunda and get information that's needed to begin to understand what's happening here in the state of Missouri when it comes to sex trafficking. It's a very serious problem. Thank you.
Further announcements? Seeing none, Senator from Cole.
Thank you, Mr. President. No further business coming before the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned until 2 p.m. Wednesday, January 25th, 2017.
You have heard the motion of the Senator from Cole. All in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate will stand adjourned.